It was a 9-0 decision ruling that Donald Trump can be on the ballot in Colorado.
And this ruling now applying to all the states where these challenges have been brought, as the voters in more than a dozen states go to the polls tomorrow.
Just in time. Thank you, Supreme Court. You're wonderful.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. We are also heard elsewhere in California. I got too much show today to go through all of the affiliates, but we're heard in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Seattle, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, not to mention all or most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us again today for the Bradcast. Yes, my sinus infection is still lingering, going into its third week now, so please forgive me if I sound cloggier than usual. But this promises to be a very, very busy week, with some 15 states holding primaries and elections on Tuesday, including, just in case today's breaking news means I don't get a chance to get back to this, in Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, here in California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, and American Samoa, all on Super Tuesday. If you haven't voted yet and you live in any of those states, it is your last chance on Tuesday and a good opportunity to make sure that you are registered as you think you are in advance of this November's critical, perhaps democracy-saving or democracy-ending presidential election. I hope I'm not overstating that, Desi Doyen.
Well, you know, in my opinion, you are not. It is that kind of an election.
I believe it is. Actually, I know that it is. Speaking of which, Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley won her first nominating contest in the GOP race over the weekend. And on Monday morning, the GOP frontrunner, Donald Trump's longtime chief financial officer, pleaded guilty to lying to officials during his testimony in Trump's recent civil fraud case in New York, in which the disgraced former president was found liable, nonetheless, for years of financial fraud and ruled liable for some $454 million in penalties now due to the state of New York. We'll get to more on those stories, hopefully a bit later this hour. But today's biggest news, of course, comes out of the corrupted and GOP-packed U.S. Supreme Court. As longtime listeners to this show know, we have been reporting on the so-called insurrectionist disqualification clause of the U.S. Constitution. That would be Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, barring those who have, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion from holding public office since 2021, before most Americans were even aware of the existence of Section 3. In fact, that year, our friends at the nonprofit election watchdog FreeSpeechForPeople.org would be the first to mention Section 3 in a public document, according to AP. Free Speech for People, as we reported on this show not long thereafter, sent letters to top election officials in all 50 states that summer, warning them not to place Donald Trump on the ballot should he run again in 2024 because he had violated that provision. None of the states took action at the time, part of a general silence in reaction to the rarely invoked section of the Constitution's post-Civil War amendment. In January of 2022, Free Speech for People filed a complaint in North Carolina to disqualify then-Republican Congressman Madison Cawthorn under Section 3 for his involvement in the rally that preceded the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6 of 2021. But Cawthorn lost his primary in that year's midterms, effectively mooting the case, which again led many to turn away from 14.3. But we stayed on it at the time, reporting as a number of cases moved forward against other apparent insurrectionists like Georgia's Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and others. Donald J. Trump in November of 2022 would, in fact, declare his own candidacy for yet another run at office after losing the presidency in 2020 and failing to steal that election, though not for lack of trying, including by inciting that violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6 as a bipartisan 57-43 majority of the U.S. Senate found him guilty of in what would become Trump's second impeachment as president. And then finally, last December, after a five-day-long trial in state court where both sides were allowed to present evidence, witnesses, testimony, the Colorado Supreme Court sided with four Republican and two unaffiliated voter plaintiffs who had filed suit to argue that Donald Trump had, in fact, engaged in insurrection and was, therefore, barred from public office and disqualified from the state's primary election, which ends this week on Super Tuesday. In fact, Colorado runs vote-by-mail ballots, vote-by-mail elections, so most of the voters in the state have already cast their vote, despite the fact that the state Supreme Court found Trump to be ineligible while staying its own ruling pending Trump's appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supremes, at least in this case, then moved very quickly to hear Trump's appeal last month, and on Monday, just weeks later, it issued its ruling, one that was not unexpected based on the questions that were asked by the 6-3 Republican court at oral arguments in February, though disappointing perhaps to actual constitutional conservatives who believe in the text of the Constitution, whether they like what it says or not, at least in theory. On Monday, seemingly ignoring the text of the U.S. Constitution, the documented originalist intentions of the framers of the 14th Amendment, and the long-established right of states to determine candidate eligibility on its own ballots, the nation's high court forced the state of Colorado to keep Donald Trump on its presidential ballot this year, despite the lower state court's ruling that, yes, he engaged in insurrection as barred by the 14th Amendment. In a relatively brief 13-page opinion and a 9-0 unanimous opinion, at least in part, accompanied by one concurrence from Justice Amy Coney Barrett and another seething one from the three liberals on the bench, the court found a previously unknown bar for Section 3 in the Constitution that, in fact, the question of Trump's disqualification and apparently that of any federal office holders or seekers is a question left not to the states to determine who qualifies for their ballots. It's not even left to the federal courts. It's left to Congress, so saith the Supreme Court. Quote, responsibility for enforcing Section 3 against federal office holders and candidates rests with Congress and not the states, the court ruled. Who knew? Apparently, the framers of the amendment didn't, since they only note in the 14th Amendment's Section 5 that, quote, the Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article, not that they must do so in order for it to be executed, but that they shall have the power to do so if they wish. In the 150 years since passage, Congress has chosen not to execute that power, even as the provision has been invoked a number of times in those years, finding, you know, insurrectionists could not serve without any such legislation by Congress. Quote, Congress's Section 5 power is critical when it comes to Section 3, said the court, citing no actual constitutional authority for that. Pardon me, but rather their liberal reading of the amendment, or in truth, in this case, a reading made up out of whole cloth to seemingly protect the preferred candidate, at least that of the court's majority, the guy who appointed three of those sitting justices. The final judgment in the case was expected, given the February 8 oral arguments, writes Law Dork's Chris Geidner today. He has followed the case closely and notes that, quote, below the surface of the court's unanimous ruling, there was a 5-4 dispute about what else the court should have done in the course of resolving the case, prompting a protest from the three Democratic appointees. Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson highlighted the dispute in a joint opinion, concurring only in the judgment of the case, but not at how their colleagues arrived at it or what else they had to say, meaning they agreed with the ultimate ruling reversing the Colorado Supreme Court, but did not join the majority's reasoning for doing so. Quote, in a case involving no federal action whatsoever, the court opines on how federal enforcement of Section 3 must proceed, the trio wrote. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, for her part, a Trump appointee, wrote only for herself, concurring in part and in the judgment of the majority, similarly disagreed with the majority's approach, but stated a belief that writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up. Whether Monday's ruling will turn the national temperature down, ultimately, well, that remains to be seen, especially since it would also seem to suggest that should Trump lose again in November, nothing would prevent Republicans from staging yet another insurrection to try and overturn the results. The opinion seems to all but ensure that the disqualification clause will now be a dead letter, at least at the federal level, and certainly as applied to Trump's 2020 coup attempt, as the justices focused instead on whose job it is to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, neatly excluding themselves from that equation, even as they did not dispute the Colorado Supreme Court ruling that, yes, Donald Trump engaged in insurrection against the United States of America. Joining us now is Chris Geidner, a recovering lawyer, a veteran legal journalist, and founder of LawDork.com, and our old friend Lisa Graves, executive director of TrueNorthResearch.org, former deputy assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice, chief counsel for nominations in the U.S. Senate, and former deputy chief for the Article III Judges Division of the U.S. court system. Chris and Lisa, welcome both of you back to the broadcast on yet another historic day.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brad and Chris. It's an honor to be on the show with you, too. Thank you both.
Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Chris, since I know you may have to leave a little bit sooner here, let me start with you. In her separate opinion, Amy Coney Barrett on Monday, of all justices, seemed to disagree with her right-wing colleagues and with those on her left. Can you explain the needle that she was trying to thread there? And does any of this actually turn the temperature down as you see it?
No. I mean, she definitely did not like what was going on. I think we can say that. This is clearly an opinion that did not want to from a justice who did not want to be there. Mm-hmm. And she tried to sort of say, as nicely as she could, that she didn't like either of the other opinions in the case. She said that basically what was in front of us did not require us to address the complicated question, mm-hmm, whether federal legislation is the exclusive vehicle through which Section 3 can be enforced. Mm-hmm. And then she says the majority's choice of a different path leaves the remaining justices with a choice of how to respond. Now, the remaining justices were her and mm-hmm. the three Democrats.
Right.
And as you said, Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson wrote a joint opinion that really did get into the nitty-gritty and explain how the majority had basically cut off the use of Section 3 going forward. And Barrett also didn't like that and sort of said that in my judgment, this is not a time to amplify disagreement with stridency. So she didn't name either side or specifically get into it, but sort of said, I don't prefer what either of you did. And I think that, I mean, I think that's probably as good as we could have expected from her. I wish she would have just joined the Democratic appointees, but I don't mm-hmm. think she could find a way to do so. And I do think it's good that she did what she did.
I don't know why it was so difficult. I mean, basically what the liberals on the court said is that, look, we agree Colorado cannot by itself make this determination. But then the court went a lot farther saying, not only can Colorado not do that, no states can do that, but more importantly, only Congress can do that. The courts themselves, even the U.S. Supreme Court, can't look at an insurrection, can't see someone who was literally, if someone gets charged or convicted of insurrection, the courts apparently have no say in whether Section 3 of the 14th Amendment can apply. Lisa Graves, where in the Constitution, tell me, please, where does it say, as the court ruled on Monday, that, you know, states have the right to bar those running for state office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but, quote, that does not extend to federal office holders and candidates. Am I missing something in the text of the Constitution there, Lisa?
It doesn't say that anywhere. You know, as you point out, Brad, the fact is that this this faction that controls the U.S. Supreme Court reached out to basically issue an advisory opinion about things that weren't before the court and invented obligations on the Constitution that simply don't exist. And there's a number of ways in which that's true mm-hmm. that are, you know, very, very disturbing. But let me just begin by calling out the cowardice of whoever wrote that opinion. Mm-hmm. The issue that is a pure per curiam opinion is an act of cowardice by these right-wing justices. We should know who wrote it. The last time we had a significant per curiam opinion in this way was Bush v. Gore. Mm-hmm. And usually, not always, but usually per curiam opinions are issued where there's little controversy and not much significance, and it doesn't really matter who wrote the opinion.
Let me just jump in for the non-law dorks. The per curiam ruling is basically everyone agrees. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what it should be.
Yeah.
Right. And here you didn't even have everyone agree. And that was similar in a way to Bush v. Gore, where it was a 5-4 decision, mm-hmm. which in essence, this was also in many respects a 5-4 decision. Although I certainly disagree with the concurring opinion in saying that we can't have a patchwork by the states. The Constitution doesn't say that either. And in fact, this patchwork notion was really a technique, an invention that came up in many ways during the argument about, you know, could we have one state decide who's on the ballot? Could we have one state play a disproportionate role in who becomes president? Well, you know, I have news for you all. That happens basically every year for every presidential election for the last couple presidential elections.
Yes. Well, and it's kind of baked into the Constitution where each state runs its own elections, determines the way it decides which electors it's going to send to Congress. I mean, the notion that, everything should be equal in all of the states as far as how we determine who's going to be the next president, we might as well have a popular vote, which is not something I would necessarily be against. But that is not the way the Constitution is written.
No, and in fact, it's not the way the Supreme Court has interpreted it either.
Yeah.
The other parallel, I suppose, that's worth noting is in Bush v. Gore, there was a similar gamesmanship being played in a way where in Florida, not all of the counties had the same problems going on in terms of how the counting was going or who was mm-hmm. challenging the counting, what the basis of the counting, what that challenge was, as you know, really quite mm-hmm. well, Brad, from your work at the time. And mm-hmm. I know Chris knows well as well, there were some counties where that process was being challenged, the whole hanging Chad, you know, could you count? Was that voter intent? But what the Supreme Court did in Bush v. Gore in that 5-4 decision, that supposed per curiam, actual per curiam decision, anonymous decision in mm-hmm. essence, was say that in essence, Florida could not have some of the states do a partial recount, even if those were the states that were in controversy, the counties that were in controversy. Mm-hmm. So in essence, they invented as well some sort of rationale that you couldn't have, you know, a determination on a countywide basis based on what was happening in that county in a way that's sort of similar to here, where the Colorado Supreme Court's decision was so well reasoned. It was actually mm-hmm. one of the best written and analyzed decisions I've read in recent years, including certainly from this Roberts court. Mm-hmm. And it sought to actually vindicate the plain language of the 14th Amendment. And I think it did so well. But here you had the U.S. Supreme Court not wanting to allow Colorado to make that independent determination based on the plain language of the 14th Amendment. And I do want to talk about this self-execution issue because I think it's huge and really shows how outrageous this anonymous Republican appointee decision that's mm-hmm. the front of that decision by the court, how outrageous and wrong that decision is.
And, you know, I got to say, though you discussed the cowardice of whoever actually wrote that opinion and not being willing to sort of put their name on it, to some extent, I see some similar cowardice, I got to say, amongst the four, we can't call them dissenters, but, you know, the Democrats in this case, the Democratic appointees in this case, who did not stand up against it, who said, I'm going to go along with this for, I think, comity sake in an election year so that we can at least have a 9-0 ruling on this part. But I got to tell you, it seems the way that these Democratic appointees get rolled over time and again, going all the way back at least to 2000 and that Bush v. Gore decision. Chris, since the majority's suggestion here is that Congress must pass enforcement legislation and that disqualification cannot be adjudicated by the courts, isn't that a disincentive at this point for Congress, at least Republicans in Congress, to pass any laws on this at all? Because as it now stands, as I understand it, the courts have conveniently decided that no one may be disqualified from the federal ballot unless Congress acts. When in fact, with today's ruling, the federal court has ruled on 14.3 disqualification, essentially in this case, by nullifying its use for any and all candidates unless Congress otherwise acts.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly cabined it down. I think there still would be the insurrection criminal mm-hmm. statute if you were prosecuted and convicted under that statute. You still would have the penalty.
Chris, let me break in there. You'd have the penalty, whatever that penalty is. First time offender, say you're sorry, pay a fine, maybe you go to jail, but nothing keeps you out of office.
Penalty of not being able to hold off.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, the point that people have made about that is it's both a strong punishment, but it also comes out of a statute that actually was in existence before the 14th Amendment.
Right.
So if that's the only law that we're using to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, why did we even pass Section 3 of the 14th Amendment?
Right.
I mean, the whole opinion, if you actually pull it apart, it falls apart, and it's based basically on the strand of this Griffin's case that was Salmon Chase when he was going to run for president acting as a circuit justice. mm-hmm. not a presidential Supreme Court opinion, mm-hmm. and then a selectively quoted floor statement from one of the backers of the 14th Amendment that the majority did get in, or the Democratic appointees did get into in their statement, talking about how that was improperly quoted. But again, as both of you have pointed out, we're stuck in this awful situation of the Democrats responding to sort of like a little phantom on the wall,
mm-hmm.
because they issued it per curiam and they weren't able to say, like, I mean, if you read the opinion, the joint opinion, which I think it's important to note, Mark Joseph Stern found mm-hmm. from Slate, when you look at some of the metadata and stuff that was left in this last minute order when we got the announcement on Sunday that an opinion would be coming Monday, that the opinion that was the joint opinion from Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson still is in some places listed as an opinion from Sotomayor, concurring in part and dissenting in part. So it does look like there were last minute changes literally up until the day on Sunday to get this part of the ruling at least unanimous.
And, you know, one part that's kind of maddening to me about this is they wanted to get it out Monday before Super Tuesday, when Colorado would be voting. But apparently the Supreme Court knows so little about the way elections are actually run. They don't know that Colorado itself runs vote by mail elections. They have been voting there for weeks at this point, and there's almost nobody left to vote on Tuesday, but they got their decision out just in time before the election. Chris, I know you have to go momentarily, so Lisa, I'm going to have you stick around for a bunch more questions. Chris, let me hit you with one more before you go. Doesn't the ruling on Monday sort of go against everything else in the 14th Amendment, like the bar against states, quote, depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, equal protection of the laws, the prohibition of slavery itself? That's all Section 1 of the same amendment.
This is the self-execution issue that uh-huh. Lisa wants to delve into and should, because it truly is just an example of, like we've been saying, like Bush v. Gore, of like, let's work backwards from the principle that we want, yep. and we're going to sort of shoehorn in mm-hmm. some principle of law that clearly can't make sense in light of the interpretation of these amendments over the past 150 years. And it's just really disappointing. I mean, I remember the first piece that I wrote when Will Bode and his co-author's law review article was posted about this Section 3 issue last summer. Mm-hmm. And I said, like, it's pretty clear that Trump is barred from being president again. Will it matter? Yeah. And, well, we basically, that was the right question to ask, and we got our answer today.
Well, I guess it's those so-called conservatives on the Supreme Court who get to pick and choose what they want to see in the Constitution, whether it's there or not. Lisa, stick around. Chris, I know I got to let you go here at the bottom of the hour. Chris Geidner, check out his work. Sign up to his Law Dork News newsletter. You will very much enjoy it and find yourself smarter for having done so. You can sign up at lawdork.com, and you can find him on the Twitter's at Chris Geidner. Chris, really appreciate you joining us at short notice today. Thank you, sir. We'll be bothering you again soon.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Lisa, you don't get to go anywhere. I got plenty more for you, including self-execution, if you'd like to talk about that. Actually, I should reword that. Self-execution of the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The premise that all of the other issues in the 14th Amendment, as I said, due process, equal protection, prohibiting slavery, That is apparently all self-executing, but only this one section of the 14th Amendment is not, and it requires Congress to pass a law before it can be used?
Well, this is, again, how these right-wing Republican appointees on the court are completely misinterpreting the law in order to get the result that they want. And in this instance, in fact, as we talked about, I think the last time we spoke, Brad, the reality is that that section of the Constitution, Section 3, is actually the inverse of that. It says there is a bar unless Congress, by a vote of a two-thirds majority, removes that bar, removes that disability. So, in fact, the plain language in its most natural reading of Section 3 is that this provision is in effect unless Congress, by a two-thirds vote, removes it. And so, in essence, it, aside from the self-executing nature of other provisions of the 14th Amendment and other provisions of the Constitution, the fact is that this particular provision, by its own terms, contemplates that this bar exists basically forever unless Congress removes it. But to go to this question of this invention by this right-wing majority, right-wing faction that controls the court, the notion that this instance actually requires affirmative legislation, there's a big flaw, and then there's a small flaw in that argument. The big flaw, as you point out, and as the concurrence slash dissent of the Democratic appointees to the court mentions, is that all of the Reconstruction Amendments, that's the 13th Amendment that bars slavery and involuntary servitude, the 14th Amendment that requires that people receive equal protection of the laws, the 15th Amendment that gave African-American men the right to vote, all of those are self-executing, meaning Congress doesn't have to do anything to make them applicable. In fact, you know, case after case after case, the concurrence cites this famous case called City of Bernie versus Flores from 1997, but there's just numerous cases that have repeatedly by previous Supreme Courts before John Roberts and Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas got, you know, in the thick of it, although Clarence was there in 97. But the fact is that over and over, the United States Supreme Court, no matter who's been on it, has understood and agreed that these amendments don't require congressional legislation to be binding law on the rest of us. And in fact, what Section 5 of the 14th Amendment does is it gives Congress additional power to enforce these with appropriate legislation, these provisions. And by that, you know, you have to understand what was happening as these amendments were passed. That 13th Amendment, the one that barred slavery, was passed in 1865 after the conclusion, the immediate conclusion of the Civil War. But what happened was the states and the Ku Klux Klan were determined to not allow people to be free. So even though the people who'd been enslaved, the African Americans who'd been enslaved, were no longer allowed to be held as slaves, the fact is that they were not then guaranteed the rights of citizens, the right to have a contract, the right to get a job, those sorts of things. And so, and there was an incredible period of intimidation. There was a lot of violence that was happening. And so Congress passed a statute to basically say, you know, when we say you can't be enslaved, we mean you get to be a citizen. And that was passed by statute. But because of this hostility, that was, you know, this racist hostility that was so dominant, certainly in the South and even among some Northerners, they felt like they had to create a 14th Amendment to ensure that, you know, you couldn't just ignore that statute. Like another, like simple majority couldn't just repeal those civil rights of African-Americans that were being created by it. So they passed the 14th Amendment to say, this is an amendment to the Constitution and you can't just repeal it. And
as if to say, let me just underscore that, as if to say, if you get rid of these laws that says no slavery, you still don't get to have slavery because now we've put it in the Constitution. And so to that same extent, with the 14th Amendment and things like due process under the law, if we did away with all of the various laws that assure due process, it wouldn't mean that we can't have due process anymore because that is still in the Constitution. It is only this one line regarding who gets to run, whether insurrectionists get to run for office or not. It is only that line in all of the 14th Amendment, as you said, the 13th and the 15th, only that one apparently at least as I understand what the Supreme Court ruled on Monday, only that one actually requires legislation before it can be executed. And by the way, only when it comes to federal office, that states are perfectly able to go and remove someone from office if they're running for state, for county, for dog catcher. It's only for federal office.
Right. And the thing about it is, like, it's astonishing, as you point out, Brad. It's astonishing because the thing about it is that the purpose, you know, if you really look at the purpose of it, it's not just that there was this insurrection, that this violent insurrection that we all saw with our own eyes on January 6th of 2021. But the fact is that the nature of this provision, this Section 3, is about what it means to take an oath to defend this Constitution, to be worthy of office, to be entrusted with power. And if you have someone who has sought to overturn this government, to destroy our democracy, they are not worthy of power, no matter how many people may want them to be in power. And certainly in the South, for example, after the Civil War, many of those Confederate officers would have been reelected by those same white citizens that back that agenda. Mm-hmm. But what this amendment says is no, you'd have to have a supermajority of both houses of Congress to remove this bar. And as you point out, Brad, what this right-wing majority, this anonymous majority of the Supreme Court has done is make this a dead letter. And as the concurrence mentioned, it basically reaches out to basically say Congress has to do X, Y, and Z in order to effectuate it. To me, this really harkens back to a decision of about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, where the U.S. Supreme Court, the same faction, although not anonymous in that instance, decided that the EPA, you know, could not basically adopt rules to protect our climate from climate change. It said that only Congress could decide, quote, major questions. Another invention, another bit of language that was nowhere in the Constitution.
Yep.
And they did this because these politicians in robes who now sit in this majority faction that they've been handpicked to basically try to repeal the major precedents of the 20th century and now really the 19th century. But, you know, they know that this Congress is broken, that the Republicans have dominated it through the filibuster, that it's very hard to pass any affirmative legislation. And so the real politic, you know, of it is they know Congress is not going to be able to pass the legislation that they envision that they would do about the Insurrection Act, just as they know with Mitch McConnell, whether he's a majority leader or not, but with the Republicans having this filibuster power over our ability to address climate change, that Congress will not be able to pass sufficient legislation to regulate corporations on climate. And so it is all in service of their extreme agenda. Yep. And this decision by the court really underscores that this court is not going to save us. It's not going to save our democracy. It's not going to help us navigate the challenges we face in the 21st century. In fact, it's going to continue to further throw obstacles in our way to deal with the problems that we face in this country, which include a rash of insurrectionists, of violent insurrectionists who are determined to help Donald Trump stay in power, get power, and what have you, including advisors like Michael Flynn, you know, out on the campaign trail and more, continuing to push this sort of violent notion. And Trump himself talking about how he would use the office in this violent, in a violent way. And there's no doubt in my mind that if he were to win, I'll just say this in my personal capacity, that he would never leave.
Well,
he would not leave office ever. And it wouldn't matter what Congress did. And it, quite frankly, wouldn't matter what the Supreme Court did, because he's not going to follow anything they say if he has the power of the presidency.
And listen, here's the thing. They don't care. They know that he is an insurrectionist. They did not even bother to dispute that part of the Colorado ruling. If you read this entire ruling on Monday, they never say, oh, well, we disagree. He didn't engage in insurrection, or he's not been found guilty of insurrection. They didn't even touch that. They know exactly what he is, and they don't care. And that is ultimately one of the lessons I take away here. Lisa, I got to let you go. But let me get back to the liberals on the court here just one more time. Because, you know, what they described as the majority's ruling. So clearly there was, you know, a majority and there were dissenters here.
Right.
But They, again, maybe for comedy, you know, to get along. Everyone, let's get along. Let's bring that noise down, as Amy Coney Barrett suggested in an election year. We'll have a 9-0 ruling on this, so maybe that'll lower the temperature. But should they stop doing that? I mean, you know, should they stop going along to get along at this point? Because it seems to me that they are getting run over full stop. And more importantly, the Constitution and the American people are getting run over full stop in case after case.
I agree with you. I don't think they should have gone along with that. I don't think they should have allowed it to be listed as a concurrence when, in fact, it certainly reads like a dissent. I suspect they were trying to get Amy Coney Barrett on their side by, you know, somehow trying to take this other road that then she ultimately rejected as supposedly, you know, not or supposedly divisive, when it's not divisive at all. It's about time for these justices in the minority to be clear about what's happening at the Supreme Court,
yep.
to not go along with it and make it try to preserve the appearance of the appearance of non-bias by this court. And the other part of that, as you and I have discussed before, is that this was a 9-0 decision, which means Clarence Thomas was part of that decision. And in some ways, because that makes it a 5-4 decision, mm-hmm. that means he may well have, in fact, in some way cast a yep. deciding vote on yep. this anonymous majority. And he had no business being on that case whatsoever, because as we all know, his wife was not only pushing for the election not to be certified, for the votes not to be counted, she was actively trying to urge state legislators in Wisconsin and Arizona to do the same. And here we have Clarence Thomas sitting again on a case that he had no business in sitting in under any ethical code by any judge in the country at any level. But he did the same in Bush v. Gore. He had no business sitting on this case, that on that case, when his wife was screening presidential appointments for the Bush administration.
Yep.
He had no business sitting on the case in Citizens United when Jenny had just received $500,000 from the billionaire benefactor Harlan Crow to stand up an organization to benefit from that Citizens United decision to attack the Affordable Care Act and other progressive measures. So this decision is corrupted at its root by the active participation in of Clarence Thomas in that decision. And I think those justices not only should have dissented and called out what was going on here and not gone along, but they also should have called out Clarence Thomas for daring to sit on that decision.
Yeah, stop playing nice is my advice to the liberals, so-called liberals on that court. Lisa Graves is the executive director of TrueNorthResearch.org. She has been covering all of these stories for so many years. That's why she's able to rattle them off there like that. She also is the former deputy assistant attorney general at the U.S. Justice Department. You can find her at TrueNorthResearch.org and on the Twitters at The Lisa Graves. I think we're going to be bothering you a whole lot this year, whether you like it or not, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Brad. A pleasure to be on, and hello to your wonderful audience. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, we got to take a short break here, but I got to tell you, you know, what really bothers me about what the court has done here, listen, if you have listened to this show for even 5 minutes in recent years, you know that I believe this year's election is a very real fight between democracy itself and an autocratic future for this nation. And in that battle, I think Donald Trump, who is calling for out loud an autocratic presidency, that he will actually be easier for Joe Biden representing democracy to defeat than, say, Nikki Haley would. And in fact, polling continues to bear that out. She does better against Biden than Trump does. So I'm not calling for, you know, the Constitution to be followed here because somehow that would work out best with my political inclinations. We have heard for years how Republicans insist that judges and justices, they may not make law. They must only interpret it. They must not be activists. They must simply interpret the text of the Constitution and the intent of the framers as written, whether we like what they have written or not. Until the far-right corrupted justices on the court find that they don't like what was written, and then they come up with all sorts of activists' unwritten findings of something in the text that nobody actually even knew was there and still can't find. And Republicans support that. They are not conservatives. They are not textualists. They are not originalists. They are hypocrites, and they are liars, and they are corrupt. Corruption and hypocrisy of the highest order, as I see it. Though, once again, it does remind us nobody's going to save us here but the voters themselves, ourselves. And even then, we may have to fight to protect the voters' verdict, whatever it may be. On that score, as all of this has played out, the primary elections for this year's presidential election and many others continue. They continued over the weekend and on to Super Tuesday. News on that, and well, I don't know if time is going to allow, but we'll have to get to that another day. Another top Donald Trump associate heading back to jail. That is straight ahead on today's Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Hey, it's Brad. Well, we are here in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation. This election year will be a big one like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Seriously. Please help the Bradcast continue in this critical election year. Support our work right now with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. Help keep the Bradcast and bradblog.com free for all. We couldn't do any of this without you. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate right now. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Nikki started to grind. Yeah. Well, she's trying to. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. There was quite a bit that we had hoped to cover. There's quite a bit we hope to cover every day. We've got to pick and choose what we can actually offer you some insight on that you may or may not hear elsewhere. Over the weekend, Nikki Haley won her first GOP nominating contest. On Sunday, she soundly defeated Donald Trump in the Republican primary in the District of Columbia, notching her first victory of the 2024 campaign. And with that victory, her campaign notes, she also became the first woman in the nation's history to win a Republican primary. With 100% of the vote tallied, Haley trounced the disgraced former president in D.C. by some 30 points, winning almost 63% of the vote to Trump's 33%. Ironically, however, the tiny D.C. primary with just over 2,000 voters total and just 19 delegates at stake, of which Haley won all of them, that D.C. primary was one that Trump attempted to use his muscle to intimidate D.C. lobbyists into participating in. Just in case you're still wondering what Trump thinks about how American democracy should work. As Politico reported in advance of the GOP primary on Sunday in the nation's capital, Donald Trump's campaign wanted Republican lobbyists in D.C. to know if they don't vote in that Sunday primary, they would not get access should the former president end up back in the White House. Quote, "If you don't bother voting, don't bother calling," said one Trump campaign official who was granted anonymity to speak about the campaign strategy. The ultimatum constitutes a blunt threat toward the influence-peddling community in D.C., one that is highly unusual for a presidential campaign, and frankly, highly unusual is a very gentle way for Politico to describe it.
Now, I'm no election law expert, but that kind of does sound like that might be illegal in some way.
I don't know. It's a Republican, a party-run primary in
right.
D.C. I don't know if you're allowed to intimidate people.
To threaten people?
Now, there's an irony here. The Republican Party maintains control over the voter data of who actually did show up to vote.
Okay.
The Trump campaign says they expect that information will be uploaded to them so that they'll have access throughout the rest of the party. And at that point, they would be able to see who voted, but not which, in theory, not which candidates they actually cast ballots for.
In theory, because presumably we do also have a right to the secret ballot in the Constitution, even in a primary run by the Republican Party that is threatening people.
That's the theory. So if the ballot remained secret in D.C., I hope that it did. I don't know. It was Republican Party was running this thing. But in fact, in muscling these lobbyists that they must show up and vote, well, the lobbyists apparently have given a lot more money to Nikki Haley's campaign than they have to Donald Trump's campaign. So in pushing these people to show up, Donald Trump may have been doing himself in by forcing a whole bunch of people to show up to vote against him. Womp womp. On Sunday, after losing all the delegates in the nation's capital to Haley, Trump's campaign issued a statement shortly after her victory, sarcastically congratulating her on being named, quote, Queen of the Swamp by the lobbyists and DC insiders that want to protect the failed status quo. That would be the lobbyists and DC insiders who they had threatened if they don't show up to vote. The victory on Sunday at least temporarily halted Trump's sweep of the GOP voting contest to date, with Super Tuesday this week and victories notched in the first four GOP states prior to the weekend. Trump reportedly swept this past weekend's other Republican contests on Saturday prior to the D.C. Primary on Sunday. He won three contests on Saturday. He doubled his delegate count as he continues the march toward the party nomination. The former president won all 39 delegates in a Republican nominating convention in Michigan. He won nearly 85% of the vote in the Idaho caucuses, securing all 32 of the delegates from that contest. He won overwhelmingly in the weekend's biggest take. That would be the Missouri caucuses, where he picked up another 51 delegates. Though in Missouri, as well as D.C., at least according to the Haley campaign, Team Trump once again used intimidation against its opponents at that caucus, at those caucuses. With Haley's campaign saying that there was voter intimidation by Trump supporters, highlighting accounts from some Haley supporters of being booed and jeered during the caucus proceedings. The statement charges, quote, reports out of the Missouri caucus today show how the Republican Party under Donald Trump has become a shrinking party that bullies and rejects anyone who doesn't take the MAGA oath of allegiance. That from Haley's campaign. That, of course, sounds to me completely plausible. This was the first test of the Missouri GOP caucus system. They had previously held primaries there. The GOP lawmakers in the state, however, canceled the primaries and decided to hold their own party-run caucuses instead. Democrats will hold a party-run primary on March 23. Now, on Monday, Republicans are holding their presidential caucuses North Dakota. They're finishing up. And despite her losses and now just one win to date, Haley said she is going to remain in the race at least through Super Tuesday, when we're going to have contests in Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, here in California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, and American Samoa. If you have yet to vote, if you live in any of those states, any of those Super Tuesday states, your last chance is, well, right now. Tuesday will be the last chance to vote. Aside from presidential races in many of those states, there are literally hundreds, actually thousands of other important races happening on Tuesday as well across the country. In addition to the presidential contests in 15 states on Tuesday, there's hotly contested judicial races, prosecutor races in two of the nation's largest counties here in L.A. County and in Harris County, that's Houston in Texas. School boards are deciding the rights of LGBTQ plus students. Partisan control of the nation's fifth most populous county, that would be San Diego County. Democrats in Texas will also be deciding who will be running against far-right MAGA Senator Ted Cruz this November. Here in California, there is a very important U.S. Senate contest as well. You should have received a ballot by now if you're a registered voter in California. Though there are a number of days following the election day that ballots are still allowed to arrive by mail if they're sent by election day. That said, at this late hour, take them. Your wisest to go to a voting center, drop off your ballot in person to make sure that it gets counted. The state this year has an open Senate seat to fill, actually twice. If you vote in California, you'll be able to vote for your favored U.S. Senate candidate twice on the same ballot, or you may decide to split your vote between them, as one election on the ballot is a primary for a special election that will take place on the same day as the general election this year in November. To fill the seat left vacant by the late Senator Dianne Feinstein, it's currently filled by Senator LaFonza Butler, who was appointed by the governor, Governor Gavin Newsom, out here. But only through the general election, when the winner of that special election will fill that seat for just a couple of months until January 3. Butler is not running in either of this week's Senate primaries. The other U.S. Senate primary on the very same ballot in California out here on Super Tuesday is for the full 6-year term for the U.S. Senate beginning on January 3. The lead candidates for both of those parties are three progressive House Democrats, Representatives Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, and Barbara Lee, along with the GOP's favorite candidate, former baseball star Steve Garvey. In both cases, for both primaries, the top two vote-getters will go on to compete in November. So if you're not registered to vote in California, or if you haven't received a ballot, or you messed up the one that was sent to you, you can still register and or vote at any voting center through Election Day in your county through Election Day on Tuesday. All right, we're going to have to pick up with all the rest on our next thrilling broadcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our board operator, Wendell Handy, to our guest today, Chris Geidner of Law Dork, Lisa Graves of True North Research, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, want to hear it again, share it with someone you know, go to bradblog.com and drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you'll find me at TheBradBlog. See you there. Until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.